Hello and welcome to Doc Talk Episode 5. My friend Captain Monroe with the International Association of Maritime and Port Executives is my co-host. Welcome, Captain.
Nice to be with you, Amy. And of course, we have Amy Andrus, the Executive Director of the Inland Rivers, Ports, and Terminals Association. Always a joy to do these with you, and a lot of great topics to talk about today.
Oh, it's always a pleasure to get to catch up with you, Captain. I don't think I've gotten to talk with you in a couple of weeks. So a couple of hot topics, and I know that we've got a lot of topics today. But first off, I want to know, Captain, what's keeping you up at night?
Well, it's been kind of interesting because we've been looking back at all of things that have been happening within the industry. And of course, the big thing that's hit the scope of everybody's attention right now is the bridge accident in Baltimore. And I think one of the things that we're encouraging port directors to do, and of course, it was followed up not too long after that by an incident up in Pittsburgh as well. Fortunately, there was no damage to those bridges. But people need to recognize that vessels have accidents, barges have accidents, and the reality is that a port director or people who are responsible for the waterways really need to spend some time looking at infrastructure. After the bridge collapse in Tampa, when it was knocked down the Sunshine Skyway, AASHTO, which is the American Association of Transportation Officials, and basically set standards for new bridge construction, but they also set standards to retrofit older bridges. And I think a good part of what happened with the bridge in Baltimore was the fact that there was no protections in place. So that has been an encouraging thing to try to get people to spend some time in. You got the Army Corps, you got the Coast Guard, you got the DOTs, and the port directors are in a really good position to be able to get their arms around this and say, let's all get together and make sure our port is protected.
I have the perfect analogy for this. The Army Corps of Engineers and one of my great friends made this analogy the other day. The Army Corps of Engineers is similar to the Highway Construction Department. They're the ones building the roads, repairing the roads, in this case, the waterways, the channels, the harbors. The Coast Guard is the emergency response, the highway patrol. So we have the highway department who's building, the highway patrol who's protecting and responding. And then we have the port director, who in this scenario is the mayor. So when we talk about this Baltimore Bridge incident, I get really not excited in a good way, but excited in a way where we can really learn from this experience, first and foremost with emergency response. Unfortunately, we just saw this devastation with the tornadoes in Oklahoma, and your elected officials, your mayors, they got on the horn and they communicated broadly with their constituents, with those that they serve. And I think that oftentimes our port directors don't have the ability to communicate with the masses being their tenants, their customers, the shippers, the owners of the cargo. So if I could encourage any of our port directors listening, it would be first and foremost to build your communication system, your database of how are we going to communicate if a disaster or if an incident, whether weather-related or man-made, happens.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that at all. I think that's smart. Port directors and port staffs, terminal staff are so busy right now, partly because of just a lack of personnel, and a lot more demands being made on folks. I felt really bad, and my sympathies went out to Jonathan Daniels, who just took the job in Baltimore. I think he'd been there for 6 weeks when this occurred, and he's a very skilled professional. To get hit with this all of a sudden, fortunately, a lot of people stepped up to the plate. But, it shouldn't take an incident like this to keep in line with communications. We're doing so many projects on the rivers and on the coastal ports and everything that good communication is critical. But it's not only external communication, it's also internal, Amy. As you know, we had last year, we had the issue with the Grimaldi ship in New York and stuff. And a lot of the response to that probably could have been better. But little things like understanding how the international shore connection works and stuff. I was talking to Beth Rooney, who's the port director there, and she had mentioned that, a lot of times, there's just so much going on that staff doesn't fully understand the capabilities of that are built into vessels for fighting fires and stuff like that. And those things have to be looked after. So, we need to take a pause. We need to sit there and say, yeah, it's great to develop business, it's great to do all of this, but the bottom line is that, is our own house really well in order? Pandemic response. We know there's another one going to be coming. Have we taken the time to look back at everything we did during, COVID and say what worked and what didn't work? And to write a new playbook.
I think a big part of the challenge that port directors and terminal managers have in regards to emergency response and proper planning is that it's difficult from a business standpoint to justify the cost of that investment. And how do we make a return on that investment? It's hard to make a return on investment in emergency response. You don't see that monetary return on the investment unless there is a disaster and it was handled properly in order to recover quickly. So I think that we as professionals need to do a better job of justifying that investment into emergency response.
Yeah, it's part of our, it's got to be part of our cost of doing business. And of course, helping our commissioners understand that as well. A lot of our commissioners really don't understand the demands on port directors and on terminal staffs and stuff. And they need to understand that this has, you need to have the financial resources, but you also need to have the personnel resources, right? You can't expect a port director in a small port to do 50 things. Because something's going to always fall off the table until, as you said, there's an accident. Then all of a sudden, what's the cost of mitigating that after you have a major issue, or an accident or a problem or something happens, a pollution event at your terminal? What's the cost of mitigating that? So that's the return on investment is not having to pay mitigation.
And the ability to recover quickly.
That's right, to get back up
But
and running.
I want to go back to the Highway Patrol, aka in this scenario, our US Coast Guard, because this is what's keeping me up at night. The US Coast Guard has entered into a forced realignment. And what that means for our stakeholders, let's just for the boat companies, the barge lines, etc. The US Coast Guard is who goes out and marks our channel, sets our buoys, maintains our day boards so that our navigators can safely navigate the waters, right? If we have less personnel, and the Commandant Linda Fagan, Admiral Linda Fagan of the US Coast Guard was quoted recently by in saying, "We cannot do the same with less." What she meant was, and there, what is happening is within the US Coast Guard, there's a 10% workforce deficit. So she's saying we have less personnel to do to carry out our mission, and we cannot do the same with less. So if we are realigning the assets within the Coast Guard and they're not patrolling the way they used to, they're not protecting or responding the way they used to, that's what's keeping me up at night. Again, we look at what's in it for our stakeholders, our boat companies and our barge lines. On the Missouri River, for example, Sector Upper Mississippi, for whatever reason, was not marking the channel in a certain fashion. So back in the Senator Claire McCaskill days, I remember some of our boat companies were actually sending out reconnaissance missions to mark their own channel. Now, when we have to do that, there is a higher cost of doing business, and we have to pass that higher cost on to the shipper. So if our prepaid, because we've all been paying for these services within the US Coast Guard, if the services aren't there, and now we have to pay double by sending out our own missions to mark our own channel, the cost for shipping on the waterways is going to increase. That's what's keeping me up at night.
Yeah, I understand that. And I think that part of the reality in all of this is that, you know, you want to recruit new people coming in. We have a lot of new people in our industry, as well as other locations. And I think the thing is that our management is getting younger because we're moving people faster through the system. But, you know, I also asked myself the question. I've noted a lot of folks from the Coast Guard who've got a great deal of experience who are retiring, you know, and I watch the continual evolution of more things being placed on the backs of the Coast Guard. I remember when I testified before Congress with then Commandant Jim Loy right after 9/11, and he made a very good point. He said to Congress, it was before Lieberman and Collins's committee, said, you know, we're now taking on, in addition to safety, maritime security. And in addition to that, we need to have the resources to be able to have trained personnel who do this. And I'm very pleased that we've had over 130 personnel from the Coast Guard take our training programs. But I think the reality in all of this is that, yeah, if there's going to be a realignment, you can't do more with less. You know, you have the Maritime Administration, for example, right, is only non-regulatory agency under DOT. And many years ago, all of the licensing requirements for personnel were all turned over to the Coast Guard, right? Maybe it's a time to rethink that and say, maybe the National Maritime Center needs to be under the Maritime Administration to take a little something off the plate of the Coast Guard. And I'm sure my Coast Guard brethren and friends will kind of roll their eyes at that one. But you know, you cannot expect the Coast Guard to do much more. And the reality is what you're saying is exactly what's going to happen.
Well, unfortunately, that's not the sentiment within the administration, because so whereas the Commandant was quoted in saying we cannot do the same with less, not only are we not expecting our Coast Guard to do the same, we're expecting them to do more. In February, President Biden signed an executive order to extend the authorities of the U.S. Coast Guard to include cyber security. And so it's definitely something where I feel that our listeners, you know, could have a voice and advocate for additional resources for our Coast Guard to not only maintain safe navigation on our river system, to continue to patrol and respond, but expand into those cybersecurity assets as well.
Yeah,
but a good thing, and I'm not just gonna downplay this administration. This administration has done some really great things. So first, in that regard, the administration has established a White House Council on Supply Chain. Now, maritime transportation, of course, is included in the supply chain. So I'm really excited to hear that the White House is focused on our supply chain and incorporating maritime transportation into it.
Well, I'm certainly pleased with that, since we have not had a comprehensive intermodal philosophy in this country since Harry Truman was president. But I think in the long run, you know, there's been a lot of pressure taken off the supply chain because we've had a significant decrease in the amount of imports and the movement of cargo. You know, obviously, you know, with inflation and high debt, you know, we've seen less purchases according to the National Retail Foundation. But I think in the long run, what we begin to think about is the aspect that the pressure has taken off because the volume has decreased. But have we really solved the problems? And, you know, we've had task force and we've had these other groups created over the years and stuff like that. But the proof is going to be in the pudding, Amy. And I think in the long run, you know, if we face another crisis, if we begin to see, as we're seeing right now, the amount of import cargo increasing, the amount of export cargo increasing, the amount of cargo moving on the river system and stuff like, have we solved the problems with congestion? Have we solved the problems with warehouse hours? Have we solved the driver issue? Have we solved all of the elements that are tied in with it? You know, it's not just about ports and it's not just about the waterways. It's about the whole logistics system, right? And until there's a comprehensive policy that comes from the administration on down, not just committees, but people who are actually doing something, about.
Exactly. So color me naive, because it's my hope that this White House Council on the Supply Chain can initiate a cohesive river management system. Our country's lacking. It's lacking a cohesive river management system. And what I mean by that, you have, again, highs and lows, fluctuations of river rise and fall, but there doesn't seem to be a cohesive communication between agencies, federal or state. So perhaps this White House counsel could make the recommendation to the proper agencies that a cohesive river management system be put in place. What we just saw at the Demopolis lock on the Tennessee Tombigbee River system is a massive failure because of the lack of improvements at that dam. So we had to shut down the navigation at Demopolis, which then shifts the cargo and puts a higher pressure on Mississippi River traffic. It shifts the supply chain in a way. But I can tell you that the stakeholders and the agencies on this side didn't know what this side were doing. There doesn't seem to be any cohesive communication or river management happening within the agencies. So it's my dream that this White House counsel does pay attention to that.
Well, you know as well as I do, Amy, that with every new administration that comes in, if we get a new administration, that things often fail. There needs to be a structure put in place that's going to continue no matter what happens, no matter who the administration is, right? This can't be something that changes with politics, and it can't be something that changes with bureaucracies. It has to land, and it has to exist, and it has to remain in place beyond administrative changes, and it has to filter through. And it's not just what happens on the inland system, it's also what happens on the coastal system as well. There's going to be some massive changes in the way we begin to do things in our side, which is going to have a big impact on the inland side. And you've got new on your system, you have new port facilities that are going in place. The Port of New Orleans is building the St. Bernard Parish, and building that facility down there. Plaquemines is trying to build and look at their development of a new facility. So there's going to be a lot of changes and impacts on the river system. But the thing is we're doing it, this port, this port, this port, this port, this port, as opposed to doing it in a comprehensive approach. When a former chief of staff got up and he talked about we're investing in infrastructure, our roadways, our railways, and our runways, we were all sitting there going like, yeah, what did you forget? So hopefully as time goes on, not only a comprehensive system on the waterways, but something that takes into account all intermodalism, all ports, the supply chain, and it's going to exist beyond the election.
So something that you said there really stuck with me, and it was the continuity. But if we do get a new administration, or whether we don't, in President Trump's administration, he too signed an executive order that established a water resources committee, bringing together all agencies that had anything to do with operation or maintenance of river transportation. I was really excited about that one, and then President Biden was elected and he squashed that committee. Now President Biden has created the White House Council, and if we get a new administration, it's possible they're going to squash that one too. It should be continuity of the supply chain and the agencies and the councils or the committees that are engaged in river management, right? So what can we do as advocates, as good stewards of this idea, is say it shouldn't be by executive order. We're glad that the administration is recognizing it and is establishing via executive order these committees and caucuses, right, or councils. But it should be a Congress approach. Congress needs to implement, create, and pass laws that will create the agency, council, et cetera. That is the continuity. And I think that we, you and I, our organizations, our members, and our listeners can advocate for that.
Yeah, and of course, Congress has been very efficient. And I say that with tongue in cheek. I think the reality is that somewhere along the line, if you look at, for example, the Department of Transportation, to have a senior official under there, like an assistant secretary of transportation mandated by Congress, who deals with logistics issues, all right, who begins to focus on the aspect of how do we coordinate and pull all these activities together. One of the problems that we see is that there are so many individual interests here, that there's just no one way to fix it, right? But you're absolutely right. I think if congressional mandate was put there in place, and I'll certainly talk to my delegation about it, to say, hey, look, it's going to happen again. We're going to have another stall. We have all of these resources, and it's great to be able to do, give a lot of money to everybody else, but we need to focus inwardly. And to the positive side of that, we've seen, the Port Infrastructure Development Program, PDIP, has been very effective. I'm glad that 20% went to the smaller ports and stuff, that was a big win on your part, to be able to get them to do that. But we're investing a lot in our infrastructure, and this is a good time to do it because tonnage numbers are down, TEU movement is down, and I think in the long run, now's a good time to invest. And I'm hoping that that program continues if we do have an administrative change.
Absolutely. Well, that one is passed by Congress. And I actually just spent an entire week up in Washington last week. My entire team, or 2 weeks ago, my team went up there. We took a delegation of about 30 members and board members to Washington and met with about 70 different offices. And I can tell you, Congress is doing great things, despite what we see on the TV and in our news stations. They are doing great things and they want to work together for the benefit of the nation. It just so happens that river transportation or infrastructure isn't controversial or sexy, so that doesn't make the news. But
Oh,
there
come
is
on.
so much.
You don't consider rivers sexy?
No.
Please.
No. So, but the point is, they are doing great things and they want to help, and it's up to us to help them help us by providing them, with the ideas and the resources that are going to help our members and in both of our respective organizations grow their business.
Yeah, no doubt. And I think that we need to be much more proactive in bringing that to people's place. There's plenty of lobbyists knocking on doors, and I think the reality is that we represent very large swaths of professionals in the industry, and they need to be able to be vocal as well. And I do see a lot of positive things coming. I know we always get to focus on the negative and everything, after the attacks in the Red Sea and everything like that, which are ongoing, but not as bad as they were. I've watched the worldwide container rates come down and stabilize. They had gotten up, the average had gotten up to around $4,000. They're now stabilized somewhere in the neighborhood of about $2,700, which is going to create opportunities for your exports, coming out of the river system and stuff like that. I see a lot of the redeployment of the empties. A lot of, they were not taking a lot of empties back to the Far East and stuff, to China and places, because they were just had too many over there. I'm starting to see the empties go down, and those are being picked up and returned, which is opening opportunities for your export market and stuff like that. And I think that's been important. And the FMC has been very positive, Federal Maritime Commission, in making sure that our shippers, inland shippers, coastal shippers, are not being taken advantage of by the steamship lines. They've issued a lot of fines, and have kind of got a lot of things under control in regards to that. And that was a congressional action that gave the FMC the ability to be able to do that. So that was very positive. Unfortunately, the only time that people ever focus on our industry is when we have a problem, ever given bridge knocked down, low water systems and stuff. There are a lot of positive things that have been happening. And I think a lot of our members have worked very hard to try to bring that to the forefront, and trying to capture people's attention, when so much else is going on, that's always been very challenging. So, it's you. I know you certainly do a good job articulating for your delegations, what the key issues are. and getting them to move in the right direction. And we certainly hope that we do the same with ours.
Well, for both of our respective organizations members and the stakeholders and our listeners all over the world, really, it's about education and it's about learning from experiences, learning from each other. What have you gone through that I could potentially learn from? And so I think that's what is really kind of cool about our organizations, that we can bring these professionals together so that they can learn from each other. For example, within the Inland Rivers Ports and Terminals Association, we're holding all of our spring basin meetings. We're gathering all of the members within the basin to talk about some of these challenges, but more importantly, strategize on those solutions. And we're in the middle of planning our massive annual conference. It's our 50th anniversary of an organization. So I'm so excited that there are these opportunities to learn from each other, to educate each other, et cetera. So that one's going to take place in Memphis in September. So I do hope, I know that you in particular can't join us on that one, Captain, but I do hope that our listeners consider, coming to conference and learning from each other, and just having the opportunity to network with each other.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm sorry, unfortunately, I have to take one for the team, and I'm teaching executive program out in Hawaii that week. So I'll have my Speedo with me, and my suntan oil. But anyway, one thing that we've seen come down from multiple administrations and stuff is the whole issue about, climate change and everything, and zero emissions at our ports and our terminals and stuff. And it's been kind of interesting in the last year watching sort of the experience of the people who have taken our course and the discussions we've had regarding, new electric equipment and hydrogen fueled equipment, emissions controls. And I know our tugs, our advanced diesel engines have really made a big impact on reducing emissions and everything. Europe is putting in a CO2 standard, which will occur over the next several decades and stuff. But I think one of the big issues that both your members and my members will have in common, and I mean, a lot of your members are also members of our organization, is the aspect of what's the right equipment for our terminals and our ports and stuff. And there's been kind of an interesting chase with, particularly with electric equipment. Because it works pretty well down in your neck of the woods, down south there, when you get into the Gulf of Mexico and southern climate, south of the, as we say, south of the Mason-Dixon line seems to be just fine, right? But once you get up in our neck of the woods, the electric batteries are not charging fully. They're not getting the full production out of them. So the northern ports are starting to look at aspects of things like hydrogen, which is a very effective fuel, but then there's a supply issue. So I think that'd be very interesting in hearing what your members have to think about the aspects of getting the zero emissions and also doing it in a manner that's, with it not just chasing a shiny penny here, but actually working with equipment and everything that is effective. And I'd love to see more US companies developing advanced systems and advanced equipment, that are zero emission based, and not necessarily always electric. I think it really depends. I think it's going to be a multiple solutions, but I'd be interested in hearing what your members think about it. And if I was going to be there, I'd certainly bring it up. So I have to leave it to you to do that.
We will certainly be addressing alternative and additional fuels at conference. What is the best fuel source for the right, transload? So yes, we will be the pros and the cons, right? And because the EPA has just released all these funds to electrify the cargo handling equipment, there are more stakeholders than normal looking at the effectiveness of electrified material handlers, et cetera. So it is important that we're having honest discussions about what is working, what's not working, how were some of these challenges overcome, et cetera. So yes, we will be addressing this at conference.
Sounds good. Well, I hope in the course of time that we're able to provide some good input. And I know that we've been very fortunate that a lot of the people who take our courses and stuff have been, you know, encouraged to contact their delegations, their agencies, and everything like that. So, you know, like everything, you know, regulations need to be flexible. And hopefully the agencies will understand that, you know. And yes, you know, nobody wants to pollute the air. Nobody wants to see, you know, climate change to the extent that we have an impact on it. And of course, you know, my opinion on it is that yes, we certainly add to it, but I also think it's part of the natural phenomena of the change in the orbit. And I was very pleased to listen to a climatologist who is well respected, who basically said, yeah, there's no question that we affect the air, we affect global warming and climate change, but a good portion of it may be just a natural phenomenon of the Earth. You know, the Earth is wobbling. It's an oblate spheroid. It's the shape of an egg, basically. And the thing that I first caught a couple years ago was that magnetic north, which used to be in Canada, is now in Russia. All right. So, which means that the Earth is changing on its axis. So, may not be entirely the issue, but certainly none of us want to breathe anything bad, and we don't want to see any addition. What I found was fascinating. I actually listened to a guy talking on a radio who blames ships for the warming of the seas. And I says, now why is that? He says, well, now they have all this, you know, low pollution engines and low pollution fuels and everything like that. You know, they're not putting as much CO2 in the atmosphere, and so the atmosphere is you know, is not filtering out the sunlight like it used to, so it's warming the ocean. So I'm going like, yeah, okay, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
Right, exactly.
What are you
Well,
going to do?
Captain, we're out of time. It's been a pleasure catching up with you.
Always.
I am very excited to continue this and get I'm very excited to continue this with you and certainly look forward to our next episode.
Sounds good. Well, thank you very much, Amy, and to all our listeners. I hope you found this interesting. Of course, you know, I like to get on the tirade, so she's much more political than I am.
God help us all if that's the case.
Have a great day, everybody. And Amy, good to talk to you again.
Thank you, sir.